All right. What's up, Pretty?
What's up, Dom?
So Pretty arrived. Pretty Shiratana. I think I always pronounce your last name wrong. I apologize for that.
Yes, no, that's correct.
But A, thank you for being our inaugural guinea pig guest for office hours.
Seriously, thank you for asking.
Yeah. And so what we're going to try to do, for anybody that's hasn't read our posts and stuff, basically the premise of this, we wanted to start a radio station, mainly just to have an excuse to talk to designers and artists and architects and just people doing kind of amazing creative stuff. Have an excuse to bring them in and talk to us, but also with this series called Office Hours, try to introduce the neighborhood to these people as well, especially kind of, you know, middle school, high school kids who are trying to figure out things that they want to do. Is it possible to go into a creative field and make a profession out of it? Is it possible to do something different? So reason I thought you'd be a great first guest mm-hmm. is not only are you doing three, at least, by last count, kind of amazing things.
At the moment.
But also, I think obviously being an Asian American, I think coming up in that in the U.S., that's obviously very relevant to kind of what we're talking about today. So I'd love to just kind of start off. Maybe we'll work backwards in terms of what you're doing. So just to give a quick sense, what are you up to today?
Today being Friday?
Today being Friday.
Well, first of all, I was hustling over here from another meeting, so apologies for having to start a few minutes late.
No problem.
Unlike the good Asian, I sometimes have a problem keeping track of time. Probably goes back to my roots as a pretty solid C plus B minus student. We'll talk about that later.
Don't fall in his footsteps, kid.
But the things that I'm working on, and hello everyone out there. So background is in architecture, and am practicing in architecture with my own architecture practice, which is called MN Design Professional Corporation. So I started that with two business partners back in 2014. So that set up and running. Can talk more a little bit about that later. Actually, we're here on Monday with the business partners.
Stay tuned. So this is kind of a preview. Monday, Preeti and the whole team will be here in the afternoon, kind of running their shop out of the space. That's right. Anybody that's curious, please stop by, hang out, bug them, keep them from doing their real work.
Absolutely.
And then they have a couple of special guests coming in, which is really exciting.
But very exciting. The other thing that I'm working on is actually in the tech space. It's a renovation platform called Sweeten, as in home sweet home. The name is very consumer friendly because the premise of the platform is to make renovating accessible to all because it's very difficult.
That's the first time I've ever piece that together, that Sweeten.
Sweeten your home. And the way that platform works, we're essentially a talent agency for the city's best GCs, and we match homeowners to great general contractors, and then we help to oversee and manage those general contractors throughout the entire renovation. So it's been around for a few years, has won a bunch of accolades. You can just look up Sweeten.com. But that is something that I've been very involved with since around its launch. And then the third thing is Apex for Youth. And so Apex is how you and I connected. And it is a nonprofit youth organization that serves primarily at-risk Asian American and immigrant youth here in New York City, providing them with after-school programs such as mentoring, education, test prep, organized sports from K through 12. And it is has become one of the largest youth organizations in the city, and happens to be one of the favorites of Presidents Obama and the Clintons. But it's how you and I connected, because I sit on the board of that, and I know you're, through mutual friends, you've become a supporter and has really allowed us to grow close over the years. But yeah, so those are the three main things.
Can you just quickly, before you get into the rest, can you just describe what you do with Apex, what you do for Apex, what your role is?
Yeah, so I really quick, I started off as a volunteer when I first moved to New York in 01, wanted to find a cause that really resonated with me. And so a youth organization that targets at-risk Asians. And I know the at-risk part sounds a bit like an oxymoron when you think of Asians, but the reason why this organization exists and is really relevant is that there's, you know, this is a community that is the largest community living in poverty here in the city, according to the census. These are kids who, believe it or not, while they overpopulate all the top exam schools like Stuyvesant, Bronx Science, Brooklyn Tech, that's true. They represent around 8,000 kids out of the 140,000 here in New York City Department of Ed schools. And what's crazy is that stats that people don't know is that those other 132,000 kids, you know, not only are the majority living in poverty, but also they have something like a 1 in 5 dropout rate from schools. And it's just, you know, these are kids whose parents just came to the States. They don't speak English well. They don't understand the culture, the school systems. The kids struggle. And I had a similar background, although not in New York City, but in the Midwest. So anyways, I was supposed to keep that a short answer.
Well, I was just curious, like, because we could make the whole series about Apex probably. But the, in terms of the, because you are working directly with, what age again?
So,
are the kids through Apex?
It's primarily 1st through 12, and we've been starting to, like, get kindergartners as well. Cool. But, yeah, the full all the way through adolescence and right before college.
And are you talking to them? I mean, you work with these kids the whole time in terms of what they want to do. What's the kind of focus?
Yeah, so
you guys work with them?
You know, what we want to do is we want to instill what we call the 3 C's, and I hope I don't mess this up. The 3 C's that we want to give them is confidence. We want to make them college ready, and we want once they go through school, we want them to come back and give back to the community, which are things that seem like common sense, but these 3 C's are actually not common in our Asian community. Like the confidence piece, having them speak up, speak out. The college ready piece is something, again, you know, we have quite a large dropout rate here in New York City, and then give back to community. Let's face it, our people aren't naturally philanthropic, so this has to be the generation that turns around and helps the next one to come up. So yeah, that's what we're working towards.
I mean, do you see, like, as with kids who you work with over a number of years, do you, I mean, besides their confidence growing, which I hope it seems like it does, and I've seen a couple of the students you guys present as they go on to college.
Yep.
Do you also see them just kind of get more optimistic, just kind of happier, more excited with what they can maybe do with themselves and their lives and what they're getting into?
You know, for sure. I mean, a lot of these kids, they grow up in really strict households. It's kind of sad, but you know those Chinatown buses everybody takes advantage of because they're a great deal. A lot of people don't realize those Chinatown buses exist because all these wave of, like, immigrants, a lot of them from mainland China, come over here, and then they get put on these buses and sent out throughout rural America to work in these fast food restaurants or whatever, you know, labor jobs, and they leave their kids here in New York with aunts, uncles, grandparents. So these kids are being raised not by their immediate family, but by people who are extensions of their family who may or may not care about them. And so, you know, teaching these kids to be proud of who they are, to be able to speak up, not to say be disobedient, but a little disobedience isn't a bad thing. In the
or independent, that, maybe.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then to, like, you know, look at to our community focuses on being a doctor or a lawyer, or engineer. And for us, it's just like, let's just figure out what is the best thing you're good at and how we can help to set you up for that in school, in high school, applying to college, et cetera. So yeah, we get a lot of kids who will come through, and like by the time they leave, it's, you know, some of them want to be actors. Some of them want be architects. I feel sorry for the parents that we sent their kids off to architecture school. Sorry. But even my own mentee was a kid who was I forgot exactly what he wanted to do. Believe it or not, I think it was sanitation worker.
That's like what he wanted to do.
Yeah, when I started mentoring him when he was like 11 or 12, and when I asked him what he wanted to be, he said sanitation worker. And I said, why? he told me, and this had to have come from his parents, who are immigrant laborers here in the city and barely speak English. My mentee told me, he's like, because you could make $55,000 a year and get a pension. And I was like, oh, word? That's the reason why?
How old was he when you first met him?
Like 10 or 11 years old. And he's like, yeah, you know something better? I was like, he's like, what do you do? I was like, I'm an architect. And I say it with a lot of pride, of course. And he's like, you can do better than that? And I was like, yeah, little kid, you can do better than that. Lo and behold.
I like this kid. It's like your junk profession isn't going to match my sanitation.
Yeah, I mean, fast forward to now, he on his own, he's extremely creative. I would take him on architecture tours. That's how we connected. Huh. He ended up going to architecture school and is now a practicing architect at the DOB.
That's amazing.
He's in his mid-20s, is a family man now.
Is he listening?
Is the breadwinner.
That's amazing.
Shout out to Eric Chang. Very proud of you, kid. But yeah, I mean, you know, this is an example of how the program can really transform not just a kid, but also his family. The schools really didn't think he was going to go very far because he was actually dropping out at the time. He had been transferred between two or three different schools because he was struggling so much.
This is in high school?
In middle school. Yeah. So this is just, you know, so Apex has been really powerful in that regards. It's kind of how Apex and my architecture worlds have always overlapped.
What I'm also curious is like how much, obviously like the environment you're in, the context you're in when you're growing up makes such a huge difference
for sure.
In terms of what you think you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Even as dumb as if you aren't exposed to an architect like yourself, you may not ever come across the idea that you could be an architect when you're early on.
For sure.
Or, you know, you're just literally seeing the people around you, the things your parents do, your parents' friends,
yep.
whatever the neighborhood people are doing.
Yep. Yep.
Not even taking into account, I think, the kind of cultural environment that your family and your kind of community creates.
Absolutely.
Or shelters you from, let's say.
Absolutely. Well, you know what's crazy is when we first started off, I took him up to Central Park, and he had never been before. Even though he's born and raised in New York City, he had spent all his time in Chinatown. Lives in the Smith Housing Projects, which is right behind Chatham Square. And when I took him to Central Park, they had never seen it before, and he was 11 years old.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he speaks English. Even now, he speaks English with a slight Chinese accent.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it's like the accent is like half Chinese, half super hood.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because growing up in the projects.
So why do you think, because we have another guest, this guy Shirt, who's right, who's coming in a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And he's from, I'm going to blow up his interview already, but he's from Queens, and he was saying one of the most essential things in terms of getting him out of that was just somebody taking him out of Queens, showing him a different borough.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, I mean, with your mentee, why do you think he never made it up to Central Park until you took him up?
I think his parents, who really lovely people, but always working, just never had the opportunity to take him out. You know, it's like, Eric was the oldest. He had a sister that's two or three years younger. And their whole community is around the Smith Housing Projects in Chinatown. So, you know, that's where they grew up. I mean, I remember one of my favorite stories is when he was like 13 or 14, we were hanging out in Union Square to go see a movie. And we were waiting we had bought tickets early and so had to kill time until the movie was going to start. So we went to the Whole Foods that had just opened around that time. And I remember taking him through Whole Foods and then walking downstairs, and there was like a cheese section, and they're giving out free cheese samples. And he's like, and I was asking him, like, do you like cheese? He's like, I don't know. So he was trying out the cheese. He's like, they're giving this out for free? I was like, yeah, just a sample. And I remember he was just like gobbled up all the samples, was like eating every sample at every stand. And he's like, you know, pretty, these white people groceries are amazing. Grocery stores are amazing. And I was like, oh, yeah, word? He's like, yeah, man, like I can just hang out in this place all the time. This is way better than Key Foods. I mean, it's getting them out, you know.
Especially that, like, a place that you could walk to from where you grew up. Like, it's that close. But obviously that world away, obviously, but like it's...
Yeah,
it's
or
physically
they,
right there.
Or you don't realize that, you know, they have these like hesitations because of whatever stigma they have coming from their neighborhoods. Like he would have never have walked in Whole Foods because he thought it was for rich white people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like stuff like that is kind of crazy. So, yeah, I mean, it's like getting somebody to break them out of their comfort zone.
That's insane. That's amazing.
See new things. For sure.
So, as you mentioned, I mean, one of the reasons me and the office, I think, wanted to do this radio show in general was because of your, or getting to actually understand mm-hmm. Apex certainly through you and yeah. getting introduced to Karen Wong and
yes.
kind of in a weird way being more part of an Asian mafia than I feel like I've ever been part of before.
I don't know if mafia was already
yeah, Asian American
but...
like book club maybe. Not so much mafia, I guess. But like the what's cool is like, you know, getting more invested in understanding Chinatown.
Yeah.
Being Chinese, but actually obviously not from Chinatown, but it's mm-hmm. actually really amazing to learn about it and learn all the intricacies and the challenges of it actually. And
for sure.
So that's kind of why that was one of the reasons we wanted to do this was just like, can we connect in some way? And we have a lot of rad friends like you and bring them by and spread a small part, basically like what you did with Apex, but a very, very, very kind of light version of it and trying to introduce a bunch of people to that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, so
the one thing I would say really quick and why I'm so excited to be able to participate and be a part of this show and love when you shared that was some of the inspiration behind it. The reason why Apex has become so impactful, you know, I mean, it's 27 years old, but the first 20 years, it was really grassroots. Grassroots being, you know, small, serving 80 kids, and we only had one full-time person and a budget of like 150K. And in just over 5 years, it's now serving over 1,000 kids, 3.2 million staff, full-time staff of approaching 20 now. And being one of the largest award-winning youth organizations in the city, the reason why it was able to grow so quickly, from my perspective, and you know, as a board member of Apex, and actually serving as board chair, is that because in my role as an architect and being in the design creative community, I was actually leveraging my peers, such as Karen Wong from the New Museum, Philip Lim, the extremely talented fashion designer. These are people who came on board early on and was just like, what can we do to help? And was able to use their networks from the creative industries to really help to elevate the organization, give it more visibility, make it more attractive to donors. Before that, it was mostly backed by finance people, which are awesome. They continue to be huge backers. But I think the traction really came about when I was able to engage my own creative community.
Which is really
interesting. And even now, like when you look at, you know, there's so many, we've gotten to a place now where I've heard people joke like, you know, if you're Asian, you're a part of this organization. Especially if you're an established one, whether in fashion or sports or politics or whoever, you're behind this organization. I really think it started off because the creative community came together to make it what it is today. So to hear you talk about that, for me, just exemplifies how powerful it is, like our friendships, but also like bringing together, you know, we're not necessarily the doctors yeah. or the lawyers or whatever, but showing like this is what it takes to really rally people has been exciting.
So you, I mean, what you do with Apex is basically... it could be a full-time job. It seems like it's a lot of time. It's but then in addition to Sweeten, which could be a full-time job, and yes. MNDPC, which could be a full-time job.
Yes.
So how do you, I mean, I'm going to get my way to how you even got into all these three things at the beginning, but like at the moment, not even how, but why are you doing all these things?
It was never my intention, you know.
Why don't you just focus on one?
And calm down. My goal right now is to, in a few short years, to be focusing on just like 1.5. Yeah. Meaning, I apologize for these sniffles. Well, this
good for radio,
change.
I guess. I don't know.
Hold on, let me do a big one. All right. So, it was never my intention. I was always a volunteer with Apex since I got to New York as a mentor, and then. I'll keep this really short, but when you hear the chronology of how stuff happens, it's like, oh, that's how you fell into three things. And now this is why I'm at a point now where I'm actively trying to transition out of these three things. All three things that I love. But basically came to New York, was a volunteer, around 08, was asked to join the board of Apex. Apex is going to be a really big theme because it kind of drove a lot of stuff. Was also practicing architecture at the same time. The volunteer stuff was just like on the side. 08 joined the board of Apex, market crashes, and then was trying to, you know, an organization that's like almost dies during the market crash because it was so small, was, you know, I had got together a bunch of board members. I became, they were like, if you want to save this, you know, be chair and president and let's try to save this thing. I didn't know what I was doing, honestly. It was just like something has to be done. And within the course of a year or two, was able to start turning around the organization, again, getting great people like Karen Wong and the creative community to support it. The turnaround of the organization, which was pretty dramatic, led me to end up going to the Kennedy School at Harvard. And the reason why is one of our major donors, who was also one of my architecture clients, was like, congratulations, you know, like Apex is like starting to thrive. Do you know what you're doing?
Better figure some shit out.
Yeah, do you know what you're doing as chair? And I was like, no, not really. I'm just doing this from the get. And she was like, I'm an alumni of the program. I want you to apply. I want you to harden those soft skills. And I'm going to write your rec letter. And as your client and as your donor, I want you better be applying.
Yeah,
so nice. That was 2010. Okay. I applied, not having any desire to go whatsoever. And I found out 6 months later I got in. And I got in specifically because of my work at Apex. Mm. Ended up going to the school while simultaneously working as an architect. And when I was up there, I met my Sweetin business partner, Gene Brownhill.
Who's here on Monday.
Yes. amazing, extremely talented, rare. I'm not just saying it's because she's my business partner, but one of the most amazing black female CEOs in tech you'll ever meet. And you'll see why when she's in next week. By the time she had just launched an early version of Sweetin, we were connected because we were both architects, which is very rare at the Kennedy School. She was a Loeb Fellow at the Graduate School of Design, was there for her thesis of why Sweetin would disrupt the whole construction industry.
Oh, so she'd already been thinking about that.
Yeah, she had launched an early beta version. This is fall 2011.
Okay.
But she was taking courses at the Kennedy School. We were introduced to a mutual friend that said, hey, you two are architects. You should meet. And I remember thinking to myself in that moment, I was like, I'm not up here at the Kennedy School
trying to
meet fucking architects. But whatever. Be polite. Hey, nice to meet you. Cool. What are you here for? You're a low fellow? Yay.
Yeah, cool, man.
What are you doing up here? And she told me about Sweetin, and I was like, holy shit, this is brilliant. But it was early days, so I was like, you know, I'm actively practicing. She's an architect, but had not been practicing for a few years because she was focusing on getting Sweetin off the ground. I was like, let me advise you. And so we would meet up for coffees once a month. And then by summer 2012, she finished her fellowship. I got my Master of Public Administration. And Sweetin was already taking off and generating revenue.
And at this point, you were already running, helping run one of the three partners of MNDBC at this point, or not yet?
No. I was working with them, but at another firm.
Okay.
But by the time we came up that fall 2012, it was like I was helping Sweetin a bit more because it was like, wow, this thing's becoming real. Let's try to raise a seed round.
So like of the three hats you wear, Sweetin actually came first? Kind of?
I was still actively practicing, but didn't have MN yet.
Yeah.
So I would say time-wise, it was about half and half. Because we went out, Gina and I went out and actively raised that first seed round, which, to be dead honest with you, I didn't think we were going to get. Yeah. but then we got the seed round. I was like, oh, shit, we need to, like, start spending this money and be a real company. And so then that's how I became, like, one foot entrenched in Sweetin, because it's like, I was by title COO. It's like, oh, we just raised this cash and now we got to spend it and hire people and everything. And then simultaneously with my architecture stuff, I had an opportunity to break off with my two business partners, Jonathan Garnett, Stephen Harper, because a couple of our clients.
Also here Monday.
Amazing, amazing, good guys and hilarious. And we had the opportunity to break off with these two really big clients that want to build with us. And, you know, this is now 2013. So 2013, seed funding for Sweetin, hiring and building out that tech company, also breaking off and starting MN. with these two other clients and starting a whole other company. And then at the same time serving as board chair of Apex and Brilliant. So that's how I got entrenched.
So you basically, you got into all three at once. It wasn't even like you did one, then added another one, then added another
one. Yeah, it's not like I could have bailed on any of the three either, because it's like
all growing, all from the heart.
Yeah, and I honestly thought one of them was going to fail, so it's all good. Like, you know, you have a very finite runway when you take seed funding. So I was like, we got like 12 months to try to get this thing off the ground, and if it doesn't, that was cool.
So you kind of fucked yourself by making them all work.
Yeah. I knew the MN thing, the architecture one, because the projects were multiple years. That was, for me, I was like, if Sweden doesn't work, then I'm just going to go all in on MN. And lo and behold, like, this is 5 years later. Sweden is like, you know, it's the biggest renovation company on the East Coast, about to go national, FYI. We've doubled in size every year since launch.
Because we'll get into this, the companies a lot on Monday.
Yeah.
What was, when was the last time you worked for someone else?
It's funny you say that. The last time I had a proper employer was, Skidmore, Owings & Merrill.
Okay.
And
it's a big architecture firm, for those that don't know.
Big. I nicknamed them, when I describe it to non-architects, they're like the McKinsey of architecture firms. They big behemoth that hires talent from top schools, gives you prestigious projects, but works you 80-plus hours a week while their salaries are slightly above average. Mm. They do not commensurate with the number of hours you put in. And then they chew you up and spit you out. Mm. Anyways, I was there... worked on some Ground Zero commission, I did it specifically to cut my teeth and learn.
Okay. And how long were you there?
2.5 years.
Okay.
2.5 years, all the way up until I was all the way up until I got fired summer of 2008.
Nice.
I always say I got fired, but technically I was laid off. I was in the first round of layoffs.
Do you think
with the market crash?
Do you think So two questions.
Yeah.
At that point, I guess before the layoff,
yeah,
had you imagined yourself just kind of continuing? Did you want to already start? Please have some. Did you already want to start in office at that point? Did you know you wanted to do something independently?
I knew I wanted to eventually, and the being let go was fortuitous because it was July of 2008. And I actually was planning to quit Labor Day. Mm. So they just beat me to it.
Does that piss you off?
not at all, because it gave me an awesome summer. to be honest with you, so, you know, like you did my Master of Architecture at Columbia, wanted to work with Star Architects, so had gone to Paris and worked with Jean Nouvel for a bit. Had done some freelance work on my own to see if, you know, if I could be like my own practitioner, which it turns out I hated. I hated doing it by myself. There's some things about architecture I'm great at and some things I absolutely
despise. So you tried it for a little bit, just being by yourself.
I tried it for a year. Huh. That was around 2004, 2005.
Oh, okay. So I'll go, okay.
And then...
so that was before SOM.
Yeah. And then one of my colleagues at SOM, they were building out the department, and he knew that I was looking for work and offered me a position, which, you know, I was very reluctant, but then thought to myself, this company is one of the most efficient corporate battleships out there. I'm going to go and cut my teeth and learn how the company works. And I went specifically, I in many ways, when you're wanting to aspire to be, you know, working and learning from Star Architects, in many ways, I was like, oh, this kind of is a downgrade for where I envisioned my career or how to build my CV. But at the same time, I was like, fuck it. I need to learn how to build a great company from the best. So
I mean, it is also, I mean, like, in so many ways, one of the best architecture firms in the world. It's like an incredibly...
Absolutely.
I mean, it's an incredible architecture firm for what it is, especially, but...
Absolutely. I mean, to be honest with you, there were so many things about the way they're structured, the way they operate. They are extremely, very disciplined about their process. lots of efficiencies in how they design and build. And I've incorporated bits and pieces of those learnings into how we built MN.
So like, I mean, now obviously just calling an architect is much too limiting for what you do, but before, do you remember when you wanted to be an architect? At which, yeah. Was there a turning point where you're like, oh shit, absolutely, that's something I could do?
Absolutely, I can pinpoint it. If I really wanted to, I told myself to do this, I can probably find the actual date. it goes back to 11 years old, fifth grade, indoor recess because it was raining outside. The kid sitting next to me, Darren Kurth.
Remember his name? This is crazy.
This is back in Normal, Illinois, people. Normal, which is
where you grew up.
Yes, rural community in central Illinois, 2 hours from any major metropolis. So I sat next to this kid, Darren Kurth, whose dad was a GC, and they were designing their house.
Does Darren know this? Have you
Darren,
told him?
No, I haven't had. I haven't been in
Darren,
contact.
Darren, if you're listening.
Yeah, yeah. If you're out there, what up? I know we haven't talked since middle school. But Darren had a bunch of architecture templates and was...
What does that mean?
Are they called templates? You know, it's like the drawing templates like the with door swings
to trace?
And toilets. And
like the plastic things you
trace
with?
Yeah, like that old school shit.
He just had them like with him?
Yeah, at recess, and he was like drawing floor plans.
So he was like a super nerd.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
Darren was, he was, I was the best drawer in growing up, and Darren was arguably second best. I know he always thought he was the best, but Darren,
he needed those templates, obviously.
Yeah, he needed those templates. But he sat next to me, and so I drew up my dream house, complete with tennis courts and outdoor swimming pool that became a massive indoor jacuzzi. From that moment on, I knew I always wanted to be an architect.
Wait, so this was fifth grade?
Fifth grade.
You were designing a house?
Yeah. I knew, like, and then looking back, my mom would say, like, you were always building forts, indoors or outdoors. And what's crazy, kids build forts all the time. No joke. My indoor forts were duplexes. People would always say, they're like, yeah, looking back, you always had those duplex forts, like you're like an 8-year-old kid.
Had amazing amenities, like probably egress.
Yeah.
Everything in there.
Because we had this massive like dining table that can seat 12 people. So, you know, you can be under the dining table, on top of the dining table. I hung things from the suspended ceiling that we had. It was amazing. I did that when I was like 8. Anyways, so it was... undergraduate, University of Illinois in Champaign, next to my hometown in architecture, came to Columbia to do my master's, which brought me to New York now 18 years ago. And yeah, I've never wanted to be anything but an architect.
Did you know it when you were making forts or when you and Darren were drawing houses? Did you know that architecture was a profession? Like, did you know that I could actually make my life by doing this professionally at that point? I don't know who thinks of that in fifth grade.
At 11, I did, because I remember I told my mom I wanted to be an architect.
Did you know other architects?
No. I didn't. And here's the thing that's crazy. When I got to U of I and we started my first intro to architecture course, which was the fall of freshman year, Architecture 199, and I started to like learn what architecture was, you know, I actually kind of hated it. Right. And then I did... my first semester of studio sophomore year and bombed. Like the professor, Paul Armstrong, who I think is still there, is a director of the program, actually pulled me aside towards the end of the semester. I was like, you should consider some other major because you're not
good at
this.
And tables.
Yeah, I didn't expect the rigor of the studies. I didn't, like, we were doing like, I don't know, these like figure relief. I can't even remember. And then cutting X-Acto blades on Strathmore all day. I was like, this is not the architecture I was expecting. I remember Prince Charles was just starting his school that was teaching more classic architecture.
Prince Charles has a school that teaches architecture?
Yeah, because he didn't want to like, whatever is like this more like, I'm going to butcher it, progressive, all more right. more modern. I'm not going to try to. FYI, I've been also removed from the vocabulary of architecture, so I can't having focused on tech and nonprofits.
It's probably for the better.
But yeah, I remember mid-90s, Prince Charles was starting a school that was going to teach more traditional classic architecture.
Right. That's weird.
And I remember at the time as a freshman thinking, yeah, that's the shit I thought I'd be doing. Man, thank God I stuck with U of I. But yeah, I mean, I actually left architecture sophomore year, started to take pre-med courses because my parents are doctors. And
you're Asian.
And I'm Asian. And I did that for a year and would watch all my friends who were still in studio and be jealous. So came back in junior year and resumed, but came in like as a beast. Like I went from like never being in studio to being like the guy who was always in studio and would develop way too many study models and variations of shit. And like, that was my reputation in undergrad. I was like, I just crank stuff.
So you had a taste of like the straight and narrow path with medicine.
Yeah. And it was like this is an awful life. No disrespect for people who want to do medicine. it's like anything, like you gotta love what you do. And I did not enjoy that. And I truly, for as much as people bitch about the profession of architecture, I really, really love it. Which you have to love something to the point of craziness to be able to power through like the tough moments. Because if you don't love it, that's when you quit. And I think I've powered through so many tough moments. I finally got to a place where I think I've found some success. It's still TBD, mm-hmm. but I'm in the, you know, there's always challenges, but I think I'm starting to be in a good place professionally.
Can you talk about like, so, fifth grade, Preeti.
Yeah.
You and Darren hanging out. But in general, like, I mean, I don't know what normal was like. Normal Illinois was like.
It was tough.
What, I don't know how to phrase this question. Like, there weren't architects that you knew. You're like, oh, I want to be like that guy, that woman. Were your parents supportive of kind of creative professions? Was there a community of people doing interesting stuff around you?
No.
This was just like out of the blue for you. Like it was completely.
Yeah. It's one of those things where it's like, so not to like get into it because I can like go down the rabbit hole, but you know, my parents moved to Normal, Illinois in 79.
From where?
Originally from Chicago and before that, Thailand. So my parents came here to do their medical residencies in Chicago. I was born in Chicago. When I was two, if they want to stay and practice in the country, they need to go to a town that needs doctors. Mm-hmm. So they moved 2 hours south to my hometown. We were one of my town's very first minorities.
Of any kind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's very, very few blacks, Latinos, and definitely I think we might have been one of the town's first Asians, period. Mm-hmm. And yeah, when I grew up, it's a small town, mostly white people. Even now, it's become much more diverse now. It's a town that State Farm has set up their headquarters and expanded it in the late 90s. So if you go now, it's actually pretty diverse. And my parents are still there practicing medicine in their 70s. They are the go-to town, one of the town doctors. But yeah, I mean, when I grew up, I had very few role models. You know, I took on, my role models ended up being rappers because, you know, I remember Doggy Style dropped in 93 and I was 16 and thinking to myself, like, what is this music? This shit is amazing. Because up until then, I was listening to, like, Paul Simon God, I can't remember. Oh, and some Guns N' Roses, which I still love. But yeah, I mean, when that music came out and it was like, just like, you know, the lyrics and what it stood for and everything, I started to have role models in the hip hop community because I wasn't exposed to many from the Asian American community.
Wait, I want
to
see if this works. I want to see if we can put on like background music.
While
you describe.
Specifically Doggy Style. I mean,
I want to look for it.
That is a transformational song for me. Like, one of the top three songs, like even when I listen to it now, I still shed a tear. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's I would say that to the song? Yeah, yeah, Doggy Style. It should be song number 10 on that album. Am I right?
Ain't No Fun.
Wait, is that song number 10? Shoot, I shouldn't know.
But it's this album, right?
Yeah, for sure.
What's the
Oh, wait.
Can you hear it? Wait, I want to see if this works.
It should be What's My Name. Oh, man. Is it? Oh, yeah, yeah. We can start right here. Yeah, this is Friday morning music.
This is amazing.
But honestly, it's like this album was like, yeah, it changed my life. It was very hard for me to figure out like what my, because here's the thing, it's like when you grow up Asian American, but you're always surrounded by white people, and you grow up feeling always kind of, it's not to like wax poetic or make it sound sad, but to like always feel like second class, or because you look different, because people always ridicule you, because being Asian's not cool. You know, as soon as like this album dropped, and I was like, wow, like there are other minorities like doing it. Because even like Blacks and Latinos in my town were so marginalized and so like beat down, that to hear this and to be, it was like defiant, you know, it was cool. I went from like, I think I was wearing a lot of like, my mom grew me up on Oshkosh Bagosh, and I wore like, do you remember Structure?
No.
Structure is a big brand. It's like an extension of, I think, one of the Express Limited brands, but it's like all khakis and flannels and vest sweaters. Huh. So I was like rocking shit like that because I didn't know better. I was dressing like my peers. And then this song came out, and I embraced this culture so much. I went like overnight into like, I asked my mom to get me Jerbos and Cross Colors and Jordans. It was like seriously overnight. I was rocking like Nike Flight baseball caps and wearing starter jackets. And I mean, back then my classmates would call me Chigger. I think it's a more common name now. But I remember back then, like 93, 94, I was like, wow, good one, you guys. Very smart.
That's amazing.
And then when I went to college freshman year, the very first day I was paired with this Filipino kid named, one of my best friends now, his name's Norway. And Norway grew up in Dalton, which is south side Chicago. And he was the quarterback in homecoming or prom king of his all-black high school. And I remember being like, yo.
Damn.
How did you do that? and Norway was my roommate, and we became like best friends, and it just made me realize like how beautiful like diversity and the fact of being accepted and embraced, which coming from normal I never experienced until U of I.
Do you think this album, I mean, just hearing this stuff for the first time, also got you out of normal? Like basically you wanted to leave
100%
and see other things and
absolutely
meet other people?
Absolutely. It also, I mean, I can speak endlessly about it, but this album, hip hop, not being afraid to like speak up to, in what my parents will call like, are you purposely disobedient? you don't have to speak with such vulgarity. It's like, I don't intend to speak with vulgarity, but sometimes you just want to say fuck.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah.
Were your parents worried? Were your parents like, what's happening to our kid?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They were worried about me all the way up until like 2 years ago. they said to me at the end of high school, I remember them being like, yo, of all the Thai doctors' children, because all the Thai doctors stayed close and I grew up with a lot of their kids, why is it of all the Thai doctors' children you have to be the worst one? And it's like, I can't help the fact that.
Do they still wait for you to kind of switch back over to medicine? Are they like,
well,
one,
you know,
day
what's crazy is like when I got that MPA degree from Harvard, and I remember my parents came to the graduation. I didn't give a shit about where I go to school and everything because I was never a good student. But I remember kind of joking to my mom. I was like, after I got my degree, my diploma at the, what's it called? The ceremony when you get your, at the graduation ceremony.
Yeah, graduation ceremony. That thing? The walk?
I turned and I gave the diploma to my mom. My parents had attended, and I was like, here you go. Now your son has a Harvard degree, because it's like every Asian parent's dream. Yeah. And my parents were like smiling, but, you know, very calm. We go to the lunch afterwards. My mom's like, you know, I'm 35 years old, and like I had no intention to have gone to school again in the first place. And my mom's like, yeah, you know, it seems like you really like to study. It's not too late for you to go back to medical school.
Still like, got time.
Your cousin was 39 when she went back to medical school. You have plenty of time to prepare for it.
Don't throw your life away, dude.
It's like, no. And seriously, like, I'm 41 now. I think it was only 2 years ago that my parents stopped asking me to go to medical school.
They're just like, it's too late.
Yeah. Yeah. And now they're just kind of like, well, you might be somewhat successful at what you do, so we'll back off.
I mean, at that point, all the more reliable Thai kids of doctors have passed you by anyway. So.
Plus, my younger brothers became a doctor, so he picked up a lot of
he
slack.
Did that pressure off you?
Yeah, yeah. And he knows that, too. Thanks, little brother. Oh, man. But yeah, I mean, even to this day, I would say the Asian identity, hip hop, and architecture are some of the three things that, for me, I think are motivations or ongoing inspirations. I always joke with my friends, like, if I could rap, I'd try to be a rapper, but I cannot. Was it even when I karaoke, I can't. It's so embarrassing.
It's rare you see like an Asian guy that can. It's not that well. Maybe now. Now is much more common. I definitely like back then.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, so I mean, you know, between practicing architecture, always having hip hop blasting at the office, and even the clientele that we've started to work with, and the fortunate project that I have with that MN has working with you and your team at Food with Hypebeast, and just being, you know, being able to work within that culture and that community is something that is I'm very excited about, but two, super proud about. You know, it's like, It's something that for me has been in many ways a childhood dream that's finally coming into fruition.
Do you have a moment where, because I mean, you mentioned a little bit confidence being one of the things that in the Apex community you kind of bring up or try to bring up in the kids. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, you know, we're starting to see more Asian representation, Asian American mm-hmm. representation, and all sorts of things, obviously, but I think that stigma or even kind of realism in some ways of the cultural side of Asians being generally thought as very good at what they do, whatever it is they do.
Yeah.
Very competent, you know, top of the class kind of people.
Yeah.
But rarely leaders in terms of or like the CEOs or the heads of anything.
Absolutely.
And I feel like a lot of that is actually even just the whatever that proverb is, like, don't be the nail that sticks up. I don't know how to say it. But you know what I mean? Like, there's that kind of resistance or not expectation within yourself that you can actually go lead things.
Absolutely.
Was there ever a moment, was there a transition for you at some point where, or you just kind of fell into suddenly running a bunch of stuff? Or did you always want to lead things?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think a lot of this stuff, you know, our community, our Asian community, whether you're Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Thai, you know, one of the common denominators is that we're really taught to be respectful of our seniors, whether within our families or in the workplace, to work hard, to keep your head down, that, you know, that eventually somehow you will be promoted or graduated into more senior levels. But that, which seems to barely work within the Asian community, even back in the mainland, does not work here when this community is predominantly non-Asian. And so I have, you know, even my mom will say things to me. They're both extremely hardworking doctors who own their practice, albeit small, in our small hometown. And but my mom even say to me, you know, as recently as in this past year, she said to me things like, you know, why are you so outspoken? You should be happy they let us be here. You know, just work hard and it will happen on its own. You know, when you are always loud, it makes yourself a target. It's like, cool.
Get that hammer, dude.
I don't have a problem with that. And for myself where it changed. It changed two different times. One was in college. The part I didn't share is that it took me 5 years to graduate. Not because of that studio thing where I tried to pursue pre-med briefly. It's because after freshman year, I got kicked out of school. I got kicked out for taking...
Not a model agent.
No. I had five courses, and I got four Fs and a C. And the C was technically an F. That was my intro to architecture course. But the professor, who was also my advisor, gave me a C and specifically said, I'm giving you a C so you don't have a 0 out of 5 GPA. Damn. And so I had a 0.9 out of 5. And I thought I was going to get probation. Like, when you're halfway through the semester and you're like, shit, I'm failing everything, you just kind of say, fuck it. And like, I'll get probation and come back strong in the spring. When you have a 0.9 out of 5, the school just kicks you out. And I had to go to junior college for a year. I had to reapply to get back in. And when I reapplied, they let me back in, but they started me off at 0.9. So I had to work. I ended up graduating with a 2.6. And when I applied for 2.6, but my architecture courses were all like A to A plus. My studio courses, I won all these design accolades and everything. I'm both at the school, and I did competitions that I was getting noted for. And when I applied for grad school, my same advisor was like, Preeti, you're like one of our best students ever. But we can't, don't bother applying to U of I because you have to have a minimum of 3.0. We won't even look at your application. I'm sorry.
That's incredible.
And I was like, it's all good.
Have you gone back there since? Have you gone back to?
I have. And that's the advisor's like, yeah, that might have been a mistake. but that same year, I had applied to Columbia and I applied to very few schools. It was the schools I was really interested in. It was Columbia, it was SciArc. SciArc, because I was fascinated by what the program was about, and Rice, because one of my studio professors, was an alumni there, and he was like, apply. And I ended up getting into all of them. And, of course, Columbia was my number one pick and wanted to be in New York and everything. So that's how I got out here. But those types of moments, and then the other one was the getting fired from SOM, because granted it's a layoff, granted there's economic downturn, but to also like to grind that hard and to like run one of their projects and like, you know, when you look in, they're like, oh yeah, don't worry, this is just we have to readjust for the markets. But then you look at everybody that was laid off in the first wave, and they're all minorities. That has never sat well with
me. Is that true? I never actually paid into that.
Yeah. And there's a whole bunch. I don't want to go deep into it because a lot of my colleagues that I work with are still there, and they're awesome people, and especially the one that gave me the opportunity. I have the utmost respect for. He's a partner there now, and I think he's one of the best architects out there. But yeah, I mean, you know, that and a few other things in my life made me realize, like, I don't think I can ever have an employer.
Yeah.
I think I need to be the employer and set different standards for how I would want to build a company and team. And so that's what we've done, whether it's at Apex or at Sweetin or at MN. We focus on culture, on diversity, and building great places to work. Obviously, my mom actually said to me recently, she goes, man, I said my mom a lot. I have an awesome mom, FYI, even though she's
thank you, moms,
as hell. But she actually said to me, she's like, I'm not surprised. I always thought you would never be able to have a boss. And yeah, I mean, granted, I have the only reason why I've been able to pull out what I have been able to so far is because I do have great partners. And it's because of them and shared beliefs and values that we've been able to have the success we have so far. But yeah, I couldn't. I'm not a. You can't take a C+ average student, which was my high school GPA was B-C+. 2.6, I think, is a C. And then coming out of Columbia, I was just a solid pass. Remember, it's high pass, low pass. I think I was just a solid pass because I had a bunch of low passes and then a few high passes to even it out. And then even my at the Kennedy School, there wasn't grades. I think I was like a solid pass there too. I'm not a good student academically. Tests and standard measurements won't be able to isn't a good metric for how I perform. But being able to get great people together, motivate them to do really game-changing work. I don't know what the metric is for that, but that's what I've been the most successful at, whether at Apex building this large youth platform, you know, from almost from nothing in 08 to what it is now, to Sweeten, which is, you'll hear more from G next week. She'll share some pretty interesting news that happened recently, but, you know, Sweeten is one of the, is becoming one of the tech darlings because it is an extremely diverse company, but is beating out much better capitalized competition out there. And even with MN, like you've seen the teams. Our teams work so well together because we have those shared values. But a company that has had zero marketing, no portfolio, a 30-second music video for a website, but we've still been able to double in size every 6 months since launch.
It's incredible.
And just signed a 6,000 square foot lease at the Woolworth building this past Monday.
You did? You guys signed it?
Yeah.
When do you guys move?
I think the reality is we take possession around February, March, and then we're going to do a gut renovation.
And you're not going to share your bathroom with those dudes?
No. No more bathroom sharing. No more like poo-poo on the toilet toilet seat. Nuh-uh. No.
You guys have made it. I think you guys have made it.
We're there now.
Damn, that is huge. That's amazing. I mean, physically huge, but also like really amazing. Monster.
Yeah, and what's great about it is it's just like with your teams. It's like getting great people together, people who are passionate, who enjoy working. When I talk to my boys who work at other firms, they're like, "Man, yeah, you know, those long hours." And it's another like a founder owner of his practice, which is also another very established practice I respect. Yeah, and the attrition and these hours, and it's like. You know, funny, I don't have any attrition issues. Everybody, we've had two people leave because they got married and moved out of the city. But other than that, everybody, we're at 11 full-time. Everybody's been with us from day one.
People seem happy there.
Yeah.
Actually, everybody we've met through office is incredible.
Right?
It was rad.
Everybody's happy. They're motivated. They do really, really great work. Our clients, who we see as collaborators, just help to make the team, like, you know, really successful. And again, like, not to blow smoke up your ass, but the reason why we've worked so well with food is because, you know, there's that value alignment and, like, the people just love working together. Like, it inspires them. And that's the stuff I'm really proud of. And again, I don't know what the metric is for that. But, yeah, I mean, that's where I've been able to spend most of my energies and be the most successful.
Last question.
Yeah.
Because we'll hear a lot more, obviously, on Monday.
Yeah.
Which I think I forgot to ask. Do you remember where you made your first dollar independently?
Legit dollar or?
No. Well, whatever you want to talk about.
Or like as an employee.
No. Like
yeah, I can
your own dollar, not someone, not an employer getting your dollar.
Somebody asked me this question and I gave them the wrong answer because I told them it was my first internship in 98 working for a hospital surveying the facility because they were planning for a renovation. I made like $3,000 that summer.
No. I mean, sorry, as like your own boss.
Oh, as my own boss?
Yeah.
So my parents had a whole bunch of, when I was young, my parents had a whole bunch of pens that were given out from pharmaceutical companies. All these really cool pens, some of them can light up. Some of them like had like three different color inks in them. And they had a shit ton at the office. So I grabbed a handful of them,
How
put them
you?
In the box. Like 10.
Okay.
No, 12, because I just started middle school. And I took it to the kids at school and sold them for a dollar each. And I would make like 20 bucks a week. And then that was during the fingerboard craze. So I made fingerboards out of thin cardboard and coloring pencils that I would just snap off to make wheels. They were rods. And I would put toothpicks to make the cardboard rigid, and then I would draw designs on top, and I would sell those for $1, and they would sell out because kids would just sit there and like play with them during class. So I was making like 20-30 bucks a week for 2 years in middle school. I always had this little box that had pens or shitty fingerboards. So that was my first dollar.
Awesome. Thank you. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Rad. Well, congrats on everything.
Thank you. Congrats on this. This is so exciting.
Thank you for being again the first guinea pig. I think it was fun. Hopefully it was good.
I apologize to any of the listeners out there that were like, man, Dougie style on Friday morning. But
I just want to put this on now. We still have a bunch of songs.
On Monday when I bring the MN team, this might be in the background.
Awesome. You without me is like hell, never without the blue note.
You never go platinum.